This is G'day World 310, where I catch up with Efficia Fellay, aka Fitz, aka 01001001 on Twitter. The very, very talented actor, writer, director of horror films. We talk about the horror film she's trying to get off the ground, Lost Not Found, plus the one that she's acting in, Death Walks the Streets. We talk about her favourite Australian horror films of all time, We talk about the importance of horror as a genre in society, the resurgence of it recently with films like Saw and Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, Robert Rodriguez's Planet Terror. Anyway, this is G'day World 310. Oh, g'day everyone, this is Cameron. You're listening to G'day World on the podcast network, and maybe also the movie show. I'm not sure, I might cross-post this, haven't really worked that out yet. I'm sitting in a delightful little cafe in South Yarra in Melbourne that I've never been to before, called Lawson's Grove. Lawson Grove. Fantastic little place, off the beaten track. And I'm sitting here with Efficia.
Efficia. Yes.
What's your surname, Efficia?
Fellay.
How do you pronounce that?
Fellay.
How do you spell that? I meant
F-E-L-E.
Which one of us is nervous?
Yeah.
And better known on Twitter as 01001001.
Yeah. Or Fizz.
Or Fizz. And why 01001001?
Well, see, that means in binary, it means either 69 or the letter E. And I didn't choose it necessarily for the 69 thing because I'm not one of those 69 people.
No. It was for the E.
Yeah.
Because you're E.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very good. Very geeky.
Yeah.
So we're here today to talk a little bit about movies. Fitz is a horror movie aficionado, writer, director, and actor. And, you know, I do a lot of shows on G'day World about entrepreneurialism and people becoming entrepreneurs. And I guess a film director is in many ways the ultimate entrepreneur. You envision something, you have to pull it all together. Yeah, the producers do a lot of work.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, you're the person in control of the creative and artistic vision and making sure it all happens and comes together.
To some extent.
No, yes, no, well.
Well, it depends.
And the studio and the producers.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But, you know, you are the, well, you know, and a CEO has a board and financiers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very rarely a one-person gig. But so I thought it'd be good to get Fitz on to talk a little bit about being a startup in the film industry, as well as giving us a rundown of the greatest horror films of all time. We had this conversation with her fiancé, Koso, at a cocktail bar in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago. And Fitz knows a lot about Australian horror films in particular, most of which I'd never heard of. And as you all know, I'm a film geek, and I like horror, but I haven't seen a lot of Australian horror. And so we're going to talk a bit about that. So let's go back a few steps, and let's talk about how you became interested in horror film. How old were you when you saw your first horror film?
Probably the earliest memory I have is when we used to live in Africa. I used to love watching documentaries on animals and predators.
Because you were born in South Africa.
Yes, I was. And my dad had a bit of a twisted, sick sense of humour, and he made me watch Jaws, but he made me watch it under the premise that it was a documentary.
And at what age?
I can't remember. It must have been like 5 or 6 or something.
So cool.
And I thought it was really funny. And I saw the moral of the story, which was humans don't belong in the sea.
Yeah.
So naturally, they're going to get preyed on.
I think we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah. So that was probably the first horror movie that I watched, but I wasn't really aware of it being a horror movie.
Is it a horror movie?
Well, I think a lot of horror movies aren't really horror movies per se. I think they're moral tales, you see.
What's the moral tale? Just humans don't belong in the water?
Yeah.
Or on the land, quite frankly.
Well, humans suffer from hubris.
Yes.
And that prompts them to try and conquer all sorts of other environments that aren't theirs.
Do we have an environment that is ours? Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a very good question.
Sitting behind a computer, that's my environment.
Yeah.
As long as I don't stray from that, I'm okay.
But then you could go as far back as saying, you know, whose land was it before you got there? know, I don't know. There's so many different levels, you know, moral tales.
So you saw Jaws at 5, and this didn't have a negative effect on you.
Well, no. I mean, well, put it this way. Dad was scared of swimming, and I loved the sea. So he was trying to scare the shit out of me. Am I allowed to say shit?
Yeah, you can say shit, just don't say fuck, cunt, or motherfucker.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yeah, so he just didn't want me to swim, and that was his kind of moral tale in me watching Jaws. What was the question?
About the impact that Jaws had on you at 5. So your dad was trying to scare you out of the water.
Yeah, and put it this way, now
that's
that's
not a very good, like, fatherly thing to do.
I guess it's not, but, you know, I think it's funny in retrospect.
Hey, kid, I'm scared of the water. You be scared too. Yeah, we'll be scared together.
Well, you know, you can understand the psychology behind it, I guess. I think, anyway. Well, put it this way, now I have a complex about swimming in bodies of water by myself. I always make sure someone else is with me so that, you know, there's a better chance of me surviving. And
the shark will get them first.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. And also in the ocean, I try not to go too deep because I like the idea that, I mean, I know that they can apparently attack you in knee-high water, and I like the idea that if I'm not too deep, then maybe I have a chance of outrunning it or something. I don't know.
Right, yeah, outrun the shark.
Yeah, sure. So I'm pretty boring when it comes to swimming. I just don't really do it much.
So
that's the long-term...
This is where your love affair with horror came from, you think?
No. See, where it really started was I think I was about 11 or 12, maybe 13, maybe 14, I don't know. And I was nagging my goth cousin, who's 9 years older than me, to amuse me. And she'd been introducing me to all sorts of bands and stuff, and I really looked up to her.
You were goth? She was a goth?
She was a goth. I was just an angsty... preteen. And she basically had enough of me whinging about being bored, and so she locked me up in the living room, shut all the blinds, and put Evil Dead on, and she said, "Do not come calling me when you're scared. Do not come and whinge to me that this is boring. Do not complain in any way. You're going to sit through this, and you're not going to move. You're not going to leave the room, nothing." And
she didn't, like, tie you up to a chair, Clockwork Orange style, and leave
almost,
your eyelids open.
Almost, yeah. I'll tell you, almost. It felt that way. Mm-hmm. So I was forced to watch Evil Dead by myself at the ripe old age of, like, 12, 13, and that scared the living bejesus out of me. And I think...
you've ever been able to go into a forest again? You're scared that it'll...
No, see,
I'm... With its root.
I am probably the most paranoid person you'll ever meet.
Really?
Yeah, I am.
You're scared of everything?
I am, because every horror movie has this moral tale. Like, if I go on a road trip to the outback, which I have done with two boys and another female, and that was actually to find a location to shoot my trailer, and...
Tell us what the trailer's called.
It's for Lost Not Found.
Yes,
the movie that I co-wrote and I'm hoping to get investment for and get it made so I can direct it, etc. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we were going to the outback on this road trip, and you know, and I was thinking to myself, oh my god, you know, two boys, two girls, we're driving in the middle of nowhere, you know, this is going to be hell. And
was it?
Well, no, it wasn't.
Did you get kidnapped and
No, but
murdered?
I'll tell you why. It's because I was the moral voice saying, no, we can't get drunk. No, we can't smoke a joint. No, you can't have sex, because that's how you get killed in horror movies, you see. So that's kind
of... So you've learnt lessons from horror movies.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I'm not a square, but to some degree my paranoia stops me from doing a lot of things that, you know, you probably otherwise would do if you were a 26-year-old in the middle of nowhere with some mates, you know. It's kind of that kind of deal. He's taking photos of me.
Just taking photos for the show. So we were talking about your love affair with horror, and you've started talking about the...
Evil Dead.
The survival lessons that you've learned through horror.
Yeah.
You know, one of the ones I've always learned is that when you're being attacked by an insane madman...
Yep.
And you think you've killed him...
Yeah.
You don't just assume that he's dead. No, you go up and you decapitate him or put at least, you know,
another
full
50
round
bullets.
Into
yeah.
his head.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some of the other lessons you've learned from horror, apart from don't do drugs when you're on a road trip?
Yeah, or what else, you know, have you camping. Learned? Don't have sex.
Ever?
Ever.
Ever. Don't, because that's when they attack? Or?
Well, you can have sex, just you have to be married.
Right, because it happens to slutty single girls,
yep.
particularly on like a camping trip.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Don't be blonde.
No, don't, is this why you dyed your hair?
Yep. Don't be stupid.
Right, which like, goes with being blonde.
Well, yeah, basically. Usually. Don't go wandering around in the dark, especially if you're a blonde chick and you're semi-clothed, going, hello, is anyone there?
If you're a blonde chick with small breasts, are you as much in danger as a blonde chick with large breasts?
Yes.
Really?
Yes,
so there's breast agnostic? Well, the same killers are breast agnostic?
Well, yeah, because the large breast thing is really a thing of the 70s. The curvy thing. Right, and right. I suppose like in the 90s and stuff, that kind of dissipated, but it's coming back, so...
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I don't think it's...
So don't be blonde, specific. Don't go walking around in the dark.
Yeah.
What else?
Don't be stupid, don't go asking if anyone's there. Don't go rummaging. Like, if you find like a cabin in the middle of nowhere that has lots of strange ephemera everywhere, like human skulls and body parts in jars, don't pick them up and look at them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, don't stall and hang out there and go, gee, this is a really spooky place. Get the hell out of there.
Run like fuck.
You know, yes. don't stand there and wait.
So there's been a big resurgence in horror, I've noticed, in the DVD store in the last, say, 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be this Japanese horror and then Hollywood remakes of Japanese horror, like The Eye and The Ring and this kind of stuff.
And The Grudge.
Do you like those films? Do you like the Japanese horror? It's very...
I love Japanese horror.
It's almost very expressionist.
It is.
You know, there's not a lot of linear story that you can follow. It's just... Yeah. And, scary shit.
And it's really moody looking as well. I really like that. One thing I love about Japanese horror is that it's very traditional. You can almost see it being played out on a Japanese theatre. You know, the way that the monsters look, or the bad guys, or the ghosts, or whatever, and their physicalization and the storytelling. I just love Japanese horror, really do.
Because they have the ring and the eye and that kind of stuff, which is more supernatural. And then they have the monsters, you have the gods. I'm going to see Cloverfield tonight.
Oh, cool.
I've got an invite to the advanced screening of that. And that's, you know, J.J. Abrahams has taken the Japanese monster stuff and trying to do it in his own way. But the stuff I like best is in the monster stuff. Right. Although, what was that big Korean monster movie?
Host.
The Host.
The Host.
That wasn't too bad.
I loved that.
It was all right. It was good. Yeah, it was kind of quirky.
Yeah, the Koreans are also really kicking ass with horror. Yeah.
I know that the Japanese have a big background with the monster movies, Godzilla and that kind of stuff. But this other horror stuff, is this new, do you think, coming out of these Asian countries?
No, I mean, as I said before, it's very traditional storytelling.
Kabuki theatre style.
Sort of. Like, for example, my roots are actually in theatre. That's sort of where everything started for me. And one form of dance, or I guess physical movement theatre stuff that I really love is a Japanese dance form called Buto. And Buto sort of came about after World War II, where artists and dancers in Hiroshima and Japan in general wanted to express the pain and the deformities and all that kind of, you know, angst that was going on. And they found that ballet was too ethereal and too happy and pretty. And they created this dance form called Buto, and it's really sort of chthonic and visceral and kind of earthy and dirty. And I see a lot of that kind of influence in Japanese horror, and that's sort of how I link it up anyway, and that's what I really love. I just, you know, you can sort of relate the two. You can see, you know, a tortured demon spirit or something, like in The Grudge, and the way it moves and it's all mangled and stuff. And I don't know, that's just how I relate things.
Okay, because they do move in a very distinctive
way. They do,
So let's talk about Australian horror.
Yeah.
Give me your top 5 Australian horror films of all time.
Okay.
We'll talk a little bit about
it. You know, when you asked me to list my top 5,
you
gave me the heads up. And I've been thinking about that. And I just can't.
Can't?
I can't. I can tell you maybe 8.
See, I think that's amazing in and of itself, because I don't think I can even rattle off the name of 5 Australian horror films. You know, I think, as I said the other day, that the last Crocodile Dundee film, I think, was a horror film, because he looked deformed and scary as all hell, Paul Hogan, in that. He looked
like somebody. Wasn't that Strange Bedfellows?
And that one too, Strange Bedfellows. He looks like somebody's taken an iron and just put it all over his face and stretched his skin when it goes off. But I mean, there's, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock, I guess, is probably the only one that really. Oh, and Wolf Creek, in terms of a recent one. But tell us about your top eight then.
All right, well, in no particular order, because there's no way I can favourite one over the other, there's Razorback, which was Russell Mulcahy's first film.
Russell Mulcahy, who went on to make There Can Be Only One.
Yeah, and...
bunch of NXS film clips.
Yeah, yeah. What else? I think he did the recent Resident Evil. Right. He did a whole bunch of stuff, which I can't remember right now. But, that was his first feature film. And, he basically, as you said, his roots were in music videos. So he came to that with a really interesting and unique style where every single frame is hyperkinetic and he tries to pack as much information in every single shot because he's used to having to work within 3 minutes, I guess. So visually, it's really unique. And Dean Semler, the cinematographer, is one of my all-time heroes.
Dean Semler was the DOP on it?
Yeah.
I mean, he went on to
Mad Max 2, Waterworld. Last night I watched Apocalypto. I didn't realise he filmed that.
Really? Does that suck?
No, it was actually surprisingly good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson's just gone so far off the Tom Cruise deep end scale for me that I can't even begin
to
stomach anything he does now.
The reason why I watched it was out of pure curiosity, right. But it was really good.
Okay.
I quite liked it.
So Razorback. Is that available on DVD? I was in... Okay.
But you probably, in most cases, have to order it in.
Right.
I can't remember how I found my copy, but I remember it was hard work.
I was in Melbourne's top cult DVD rental place, Video Dogs in Carlton, the other day, looking for it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find it, but I'm really desperate to see it.
Okay. I think Readings in Carlton either would have it or they might order it in for you.
Okay.
And
tell us about the story. It's about a pig, right?
It's about
a wild boar or something.
Yeah, it's like Jaws on land, and instead of a shark, you've got a wild boar. And we should get what's the word? Exterminated.
Humans are a disease.
Yes.
And we are the cure. Yeah. I love that line.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Razorback. We've got Long Weekend, who's written by the same screenwriter, Everett DeRoche. Who I got to meet a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And in fact, I got to meet him on the remake of Long Weekend, which is pretty exciting. Long Weekend, again, it's about humans going into the wilderness and basically abusing it, like littering and throwing their cigarette butts out and, just disrespecting and not appreciating nature. And nature literally getting her revenge, which is really cool. Yeah.
And how does nature get her revenge in the Long Weekend?
Well, that would be spoiling it, wouldn't it?
Oh, okay. Well, we just told this big pig and Razorback.
Well, let's just say nature gets her revenge.
Okay.
Yeah, just think cryptically there.
Okay, you've lost me. Okay.
You'll have to see it.
Long Weekend.
Yep, Long Weekend.
Should people see the original or the remake?
Both.
Not just saying that because you were involved in the remake.
No. I'm saying that because I was actually fortunate enough to see the little teaser of the new version of it, and it looks very similar and very different all at once, and you could only sort of judge that if you've seen the original version.
Okay.
But yeah, it's going to...
Next one. Give me more.
Okay, good. I'm going to have to pull out some paper.
I'm going to get a notes.
The Last Wave.
Tell us about The Last Wave.
The Last Wave is a Peter Weir film. I believe he did that after Picnic at Hanging Rock, and people just weren't as interested in it because it wasn't as pretty and, thriller-ish. This also has the man versus nature kind of storyline. It's a bit of a psychological thriller. It's got David Gulpilil in it, which is really cool to see. I love David Gulpilil. He's just awesome, and he steals the show. And it's a very abstract kind of film. I haven't seen it in ages. It's the kind of film that you need to see a couple of times to sort of get the hang of. And it too is a very moral story. What else? What else have I got?
Let the record show she's flipping through a notepad with lots of loose sheets of paper in it.
Messy sheets.
Scribbled stuff.
Long Weekend, Razorback, Last Wave, Road Games.
Road Games?
Road Games.
Never heard of that one.
This has Jamie Lee Curtis in it, a young Jamie Lee Curtis in it.
Wow.
And it's the formula of the story is very Hitchcock-esque. And it's kind of like somewhere between a Hitchcock movie and Steven Spielberg's Duel. And it's a psychological thriller, and there's lots of beautiful outback shots in it. It's just gorgeous. And there's this big mysterious truck following around this other truck driver. And yeah, and they play some road games together.
Sounds just like Duel.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a rip-off of Duel.
Except that Jamie Lee Curtis is in it.
Okay. She was the Scream Queen.
She was.
Late 70s, early 80s, wasn't she?
I think Halloween. This actually came about shortly after Halloween, when she was still kind of, you know, not quite a very well-known name yet.
Yeah.
But she was very, very young. It's interesting to see. It's a good film.
Okay.
I've got that one. I can lend it to you.
She was hot.
She was so cute.
Always worth seeing as young Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, yeah. And then what have I got? I've got Wake in Fright, which is quite an enigma, this film. It's also known as Outback. Now, I think I told you this the other day. They lost the original reel of the film. And it was found in a container in Boston that was marked for destruction. Now, the story behind Wake in Fright is it's actually a novel. And I've read the novel, but I haven't seen the film because you can't actually find the bloody film. It's really annoying. But it could well be one of Australia's most important horror films. It did really well in the festival rounds, and it got some amazing international acclaim. And it was very kind of real, very kind of gritty, very kind of rough around the edges. And what happened was, I mean, it's a story of a guy in this fictitious town, which is actually based on Broken Hill, who just hates it there, and he just wants to get the hell out. But he finds that he's stuck there. And the slogan, I guess, for the film is, have another beer, mate. Oh shit, I can't remember it. But anyway, it talks about the isolation, I guess, of people there, and how there's nothing to do aside from hunt brews and drink beer. And for, I guess, any kind of cosmopolitan person, that would probably be a version of hell. Now, this film was so close in its portrayal of you know, outback Australians, that Australians themselves didn't actually quite like it at all. It did very badly in Australia. And in a way, it was swept under the rug. And Australia's response to that was the creation of Crocodile Dundee, which kind of killed the serious horror for a good decade or so. You know, because from then on, globally, we were viewed as, you know, the jolly little larrikin.
Lovable larrikins.
Yeah, yeah. So Wake in Fright, it's a real enigma. As far as I know, there was a court case about who owns the actual original reel, and I know that there was an organisation that's trying to fix it, trying to clean up the reel and hopefully re-release it on DVD. I'd love to get my hands on it, and I've been talking with a few people to try and find out what's going on with that.
It's a great Australian horror film you'll never see, possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
So let's talk about your film. Let's talk about Lost, Not Found. How long have you been working on it?
Since 2004.
Okay, and you've got the screenplay.
Yep.
You've made a trailer.
Yep.
And you're trying to raise funding. Tell us what that's like as a first time filmmaker in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a lot of support for new filmmakers?
That's a tough question. I mean, the community, especially in Melbourne, is nice and small and tight knit, and everyone's always willing to help you out. You know, people volunteer to help you on set, or they'll happily lend you their camera or their services, whatever. But in terms of like getting funding and stuff, it's a bit of a different question. As with any filmmaker, I guess, there's lots of catches involved. Like, you know, do you have a name attached? And if you don't, which you need money for in the beginning.
There are no names in Australia to attach.
Well,
who do we have that's a name?
Yeah, true.
Like, get Bert Newton to a guy.
Yeah.
Actually, Bert Newton would do good in a horror film.
Well, he'd be,
he's got one of those scary-looking plastic faces now, too.
Yeah, see, now that you've said that, there's a character in Lost Not Found that...
I'm telling you, that's genius casting.
Yeah.
It's genius casting.
It's a good idea, yeah.
It's like putting Tarantino cast in Death Proof... there's the stunt car driver.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff. Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, like Kurt Russell. You have to get Bert Newton as the killer.
Yeah.
Well, the guy who did the play school host that they had do Wolf Creek.
John Jarrett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was, his wife was on play school, but he was like Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of, you know, role reversal.
Yeah,
thing.
Take
the nice guy and make him scary.
Play with the Australian kind of.
So there's this film, Film Finance Corporation, and all of these state and federal bodies that finance films. And how many people are out there at any one time trying to get money out of these guys? Is it like lots and lots and lots?
Shitloads.
Right.
Yeah. And
are they your only sources? I mean, is a private investment for films still in this country under 10BA and that kind of stuff?
Well, I would be inclined to personally look for private investors over government funding. There are. I haven't found any. I haven't been actively looking for about a year now, but I haven't found any private investors in Australia that would be interested. There's a lot of interest coming from the States. Which I'm kind of funny about because I don't want it to be an American film. You know, I don't want private investors in America to say, I'll give you $500,000 if, you know, you put an American actor or whatever.
Mm.
You know, so it's a tough position to be in, and it's a tough balance to maintain because you want to get your film made, but you don't want to compromise too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are investment bodies here, and I guess if you look hard enough, you can find them. But amazingly, anyone who's found funding won't tell you, won't give you a heads up and sort of say, hey, there's this, you know, really rich millionaire over there.
Because they're trying to protect their
Exactly.
funding, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Startups are a little bit like that as well.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's very similar.
So, as a geek, do you see the opportunities around, you know, digital production, digital handycams and all that kind of stuff as reducing the cost of producing films? Are you
Absolutely.
Exploring that kind of stuff and trying to do it Robert Rodriguez style? Hey, Cosso's joined us.
Hello.
With a Planet of the Apes shirt on. Go on, thanks. Love the shirt.
Absolutely, but I mean, we haven't really looked into the tech side of things just yet because we want to sort of have a budget before we can even dream about looking at cameras and stuff. But, you know, every first-time filmmaker or student filmmaker says, ooh, I want to film on, you know, 35mm film instead of digital. And it's really a stupid thing to say because it's way too expensive for any first-timer or student. But aside from that, digital is becoming so good now that you can replicate the look of film quite easily. So there's no need to spend that extra money to make it look all filmy, you know.
And then, I mean, you give the classic stories of guys like Roberto Rodriguez would have made El Mariachi supposedly for $10,000 that he put on his credit cards.
Yeah.
How realistic is it today to go and shoot a feature film for thousands of dollars using mini DV cams or digital handycams?
It's very realistic. I have quite a few friends that are doing that as
we speak. Particularly, I think, with horror, because, you know, horror doesn't need to look pretty.
No, it doesn't.
You know, you have Blair Witch Project is a classic example where it's, you know, the graininess and the klutziness can actually add to horror.
Yeah.
I'm just talking through my arse here. But
you're
seem to me that you could. So is that a direction that you've thought about taking with L&F?
No, absolutely not.
You want it to be pretty?
I want it to be so pretty it's ironic. You know, I want people to look at each frame of that film and go, wow, that looks like a postcard, but holy Jesus, that is the most fucked up thing I've ever seen on film. You know what I mean?
I've seen your trailer, and I thought that when I looked at the trailer, even though it was on your MySpace page, that it looked beautiful. It looked really beautiful and somehow scary.
Yeah, well, the I guess the point that I was trying to convey on the trailer, excuse me, is that at the time when we wrote Lost Not Found, there was a lot of, I had this sort of grudge against tourists coming to Australia and sort of assuming that they could
walk bloody on tourists coming to Australia, Cosso.
Sorry,
keep going.
You know, and that they could assume to walk all over Uluru, you know, without having any problems on their conscience, and I really hate that. And so Lost Not Found, in a way, was sort of spawned from that sort of sentiment. And so I wanted to play on the sort of beautiful, inviting landscape that we've got, and, you know, how picturesque the stupid little locals are, you know, how daft they are, those hicks, and then turn it completely on its head and sort of show that, you know, this beautiful landscape isn't what it looks like. You know, it's really harsh, and it will kill you if you don't know how to treat it with respect. So there's, like, my little link-in with the sort of 70s and 80s Australian
park. Is it the landscape that's killing people, or the townsfolk?
That's both.
Both?
Both. Nature is causing the townfolk to be evil. Yeah, they're a product of their environment.
Yeah. I actually find that how all the evangelical Christian churches in this country start up in places where it's just really hot.
Yeah.
And the sun kind of just fries people's brains
a
bit.
Yeah.
I see that in sort of a similar way.
Well, when we were researching for Lost Not Found, we were looking at, like, some statistics from all around Australia, but particularly from the inner Australia. And we found that there are actually higher crime rates closer to where it's really hot. In white people, Europeans, because we're not built to cope with that sort of heat and that sort of isolation, and that does send people troppo, literally. And that was really interesting, because you don't really hear about, say, you know, Aboriginal people going on killing sprees and stuff like that, do you?
Well, no, well, it's because we killed them all.
Yeah.
There's only about seven left.
Yeah.
We managed to wipe them all out. Did a bloody good job of it too, thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get back to the whole process of trying to get a film off the ground. Because, I mean, I like many people, I'm one of these wannabe filmmakers who, since I was like 20, said I'm going to make a movie one day, and I've never done anything beyond write a couple of treatments. But I'm fascinated by the process. Like, where do you start? So once you had your screenplay or your treatment, what do you do next? I mean, what are literally the next steps? Who do you go to?
Well,
what do you do?
You know, we went about it very unconventionally, I guess. We didn't know the first thing about anything to do with filmmaking when we started this project, and we were kind of learning along the way. Of course, I've got to say, probably being two young females from Melbourne kind of helped sell the thing a bit more. But, you know, nowadays when you've got sort of things like MySpace and, you know, the internet is so accessible, you just got to milk that for all you can. And that's how I've made that's how I've made so many of my contacts nowadays, you know, through the internet, through having my trailer up on MySpace, etc. And people kind of approach you. In fact, before we'd even written one line of dialogue on the script, we were just about to, actually. We were a couple of days away from starting, and we were just being cheeky. This is Phoebe Meyer and I. She's the co-creator. And we were just taking some photos of ourselves for MySpace, you know, just stuffing around. And I sat there and photoshopped a couple, and we thought, why not just send these to all the horror websites and just, like, put a slogan next to it and see what happens? You know, let's just be cheeky for the hell of it. And sure enough, about three or four major horror websites picked up on the story and asked us to please send them a treatment, send them, you know, a synopsis, something, and they'll feature us. And as I said before, I think that's probably got to do with the fact that we were two chicks. But then again, I don't want to underestimate the fact that we were very, very clever as well. What was that?
Sorry, there's a Koso side comment, back channel commentary going on here.
Cheeky. And so within a couple of days of that, Fangoria contacted us and said, look, we want to do a feature
What's
on you
Fangoria,
guys.
What's Fangoria, a horror fan site?
Yeah, it is. It's primarily a magazine, a horror magazine.
Okay.
It talks about everything horror. And their website is obviously the same thing. Fangoria has been around for like a couple of decades now. It's really a cult magazine. And when they asked us, you know, can we feature you, we were just like, oh my God, completely overjoyed. And from that article on the internet, we scored a composer who had done some decent stuff before as well. He's got quite a name for himself. And from there, we kind of built more contacts and more interest, et cetera, et cetera. It was kind of a ricochet effect, or dominoes effect, rather. So I guess for any sort of filmmaker that wants to start getting their stuff out there, I just suggest being as cheeky as you possibly can. And
if you can, be a female.
And if you can, be a female. Yeah. And if you can, don't let things like, you know, like your doubts or logic or being sensible talk you out of doing cheeky things like that. Aim really high and then work your way down if you have to. But you find that every now and then you don't have to, and, you know, it's really good.
J. Paul Getty, the American oil man / richest man in America during his lifetime, once said it takes as much energy to think big as it does to think small.
Exactly.
I found that to be true.
But I've always been like that. I've always been kind of a baptism by fire kind of person. You know, when I directed my first play, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I came out of that probably knowing more than an average 19-year-old who had already spent a year at, you know, VCA or something like that, the Victorian College of Arts. You know, so I kind of tend to do things that way, and in a way that also stops me from having blinkers on and talking myself out of stuff.
Okay, so listen, my battery's about to die here. A few last questions. What are some of your favourite horror films? Let's forget Australia. Your favourite horror films of all time, the ones that you watch over and over again.
Saw,
there you go.
Yep, yeah, very impressed by Saw.
What is it about Saw that makes it work well, do you think?
Well, aside from the fact that I've got a soft spot for the guys that created it because they're from Melbourne, I just think it's genius. You know, set a horror movie in one room, and just make it really kind of sick and twisted and clever and snappy. You know,
look at this, Cosso's got power.
Rock on.
Thanks, Chad.
Saw, The Omen. The original.
The original Omen.
Yeah, anything to do with, like, the Catholic Church and Satan scares the living crap out of me.
Oh, just Catholics scare me.
Yeah.
Christians scare the hell out of me.
I mean, I'm half Italian, you know, and, you know, a lot of my family comes from Rome, so, and some of them are, you know, pretty avid churchgoers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I felt bad when I played Marilyn Manson to my very Catholic auntie. So I seriously felt like God was going to strike me.
You're a big Marilyn Manson fan. I saw your seismic happy birthday Marilyn Manson thing a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Where you put some makeup on. That was pretty scary.
I'm a fan of him, you know, more than his music. I think he's a really clever guy. Mm. And he's capitalising on people's stupidity. And I'm just amazed that no one else has really been doing that.
How's he capitalising on people's stupidity?
Well, if you've got Middle America saying you're Satan, you're banned, you're awful, he's going to play up to that and get more media attention.
He gets free press by terrorising the white conservatives.
Exactly.
I like his music.
I do too.
Some good sort of stuff.
Yeah.
See, Alice Cooper's coming to town.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
In a couple of months. He's playing the Palm.
Really?
At Crown Casino, which is a little bit sad.
Wow.
I'm trying to get an interview with him.
Yeah.
Because, he's sort of the godfather.
We're
of,
not
of
worthy.
Scary. Yeah, that's right. Of that kind of stuff. Okay, let's talk about great horror films. So you said Saw.
Saw.
And
The Omen.
Omen. Yep.
Friday the 13th. The original, again.
Original slasher stuff.
That was the template, really. For so many films to come, you know, the typical formula of teenagers in the cabin, in the woods, having sex, doing drugs, blonde girl dies, etc. Everything looks like a cliche now because that was executed so brilliantly. What else? Suspiria by Dario Argento. It's an Italian film.
Yeah.
It is just visually, I mean, the deaths, you know, Dario is very well known for his very creative deaths, so the deaths are really cool. Plot-wise, it's kind of really out there. It's about as coherent as Japanese horror, but it's the kind of film that you just can't take your eyes off. In fact, when I have parties and stuff, I have that playing in the background and, you know, music and whatever, just because it looks... It's better than a lava lamp, you know. It's really psychedelic.
Yeah.
It's really cool. What else?
We were talking about Planet Terror and Death Proof earlier before we started recording.
Yeah.
Which I just watched Planet Terror, which is, you know, great zombie movie. I just, you know, more blood and gore and that I think in any zombie movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Do you like zombie movies? Do you like?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. I love zombie movies.
One of the things that I struggle with horror movies a lot is I like the suspension of disbelief when the storylines are too stupid.
Yeah.
I find hard to believe. And one of the things I liked about that is it kind of had a fairly contemporary sort of approach to, you know, Agent Orange type drugs being used in Afghanistan and that were creating these sort of over-the-top genetic mutations, admittedly. But it's the same with, like, vampire films and werewolf films, Underworld and that kind of stuff. I always get disappointed by vampire films because just once I wish somebody would make a vampire film that is kind of coherent and I could kind of go, wow, maybe that is...
That's plausible.
You know, it has to be really scary for me. It's got to be kind of plausible.
Well, have you seen The Hunger with Catherine Deneuve, Susan Sarandon, and Dan Bowie?
A long time ago. Yeah. I remember loving it, but I haven't seen it for 20 years.
Well, what I love about that film is that there's no corny growing of the fangs. You know, it's... They are just blood suckers. They just need blood. And I really like the usage of the stabby unk thing to open people's veins.
Okay.
I find it a bit sometimes hard to suspend my disbelief when, you know, suddenly they grow fangs and they look like they've been mashed up.
Yeah.
Although, you know, then you've got Lost Boys, which I absolutely love.
I just watched that again the other day.
Yeah,
the
it's
other
a
weekend.
Good film.
Yeah, it was okay.
Oh,
yeah.
You gotta love Kiefer. Bad Kiefer.
Kiefer was great. He was...
And the Coreys. Oh
yeah,
my God,
the Coreys
are awesome.
The Frog Brothers.
Yeah.
Kiefer, I don't know, he was 18 when he made that movie.
You're kidding.
18. It was like one of his first films.
Yeah.
It was like, just came out of nowhere.
Was that before or after Stand By Me? I think it was...
Just after,
yeah.
I think that was his film, for the film he made after Stand By Me, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And he's just, I mean, he is awesome in that. Doesn't have much to say, just looks menacing.
Yeah.
It looks badass.
Oh,
in the
man,
whole thing.
I had, like, so many childhood crushes on him from that film alone.
And I was watching the bonus stuff, and he said that people come up to him still today and say, and that's the one thing everyone always mentions is Lost Boys. He said out of everything that he's done since then, Lost Boys is still the thing that he's most known for.
It's odd, isn't it? I mean, he's done some really good stuff.
It was a bit sort of Goonies, though.
But I love the Goonies.
Cheesy, you know, kind of thing. It wasn't really scary in any fashion.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd love a good... The thing I love about the Japanese horror films is they don't try and provide any sort of rationale or explanation for what's going on. It's just
crazy shit. That's just like a, you know, a lost in translation kind of thing. You know, the Asian sort of storytelling is very different to Western storytelling. And they don't need the same sort of character archetypes and you know, character arcs and stuff like that to comprehend a story. So it's just a different sort of method of telling story. But
we were talking when we caught up a couple of weeks ago about Greek tragedies and the role of horror as a form of storytelling in society and the importance of it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about your feelings on that.
Well, the Greeks, I kind of refer to this a lot because I really think that they were onto something. The Greeks had the annual theatre festival, and it was compulsory for every citizen, albeit they were all men, but it was compulsory for every citizen to attend. And they would play three tragedies and then a comedy to sort of, you know, lift the mood a bit. And the tragedies, more often than not, were really violent and really twisted and fucked up. I mean, there was like... incest and cheating husbands and, you know, children getting eaten and all sorts of really intense kind of topics.
I'm glad you threw in the children because I was waiting for the fucked up bit. I'm going, men cheating, okay, that's normal. I was waiting for the fucked up bit. Okay, children getting eaten, that's fucked up.
You know, so what the Greeks believed was if you attend these tragedies, you will... through a process of catharsis, you'll become a better citizen because you won't feel compelled to go and do these things yourself.
Exercising your inner demons.
That's right.
Vicariously somehow.
That's right. And
when I watch The Ring or The Grudge, how does that make me a better person? It means I'm not going to try and come back and haunt people from the bottom of a well or something?
Well, I think that's a bit different. I think horror in that sort of sense, makes you remember that you're alive. Like if you get a, you know, the slightest sensation of tension or a bit of a fright from horror, I think it's doing what it's meant to do, which is remind you of your immortality. Remind you to, you know, appreciate life. That's kind of, again, the morality part. Right. Yeah. You know, don't do drugs because life is awesome enough as it is, you know. You know, I don't know. There's.
She says that she drinks her second cafe latte. Coffee's not a drug. Coffee's good. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But back to like vampires, werewolves, and all that. I'm actually acting in a vampires, demons, zombies, werewolves movie.
Which is called?
Death Walks the Streets.
And this is being made in the States, right?
Yes, it is.
How did you get that gig?
I auditioned.
Over the web?
Yes, yeah.
Awesome.
But, you know, in all honesty, I was already a big fan of the film, a big supporter. You know, the director, James Zahn, and I had a bit of a rapport going on. You know, we were sort of sharing notes, because we looked at each other as a brother-sister kind of thing, you know, and helping each other out. You know, our first articles that were ever published were also on Fangoria, and we share a composer, funnily enough, and all that sort of business. So, you know, together we sort of had this rapport, and one day he said, look, there's this character that I'd really love you to audition for. You know, would you be up for it? And I thought, oh my God, all my dreams have come true, you know. But I didn't honestly think I'd get the role. And yeah, sent them a video and they were happy with it.
Now, I looked at the website for Death Walks the Streets the other day, and it seems to be very sort of underground kind of production thing that they're working on here. It's a grassroots kind of film.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, reading through the website, it didn't seem like they were working with a big studio and providing funding.
No,
it was kind of a bunch of
completely independent.
Yeah.
They're aiming to make like the Star Wars of horror independently,
right,
which is quite amazing.
Yeah.
It's a planned trilogy. It's got a comic book and a video game coming up as well.
Wow.
And
has it already been shot?
No, it hasn't. The film's been in production for a good couple of years now. Just sort of, you know, there's been hitches along the way that, you know, we've had to get over and stuff. And just recently, basically, we sort of detached from the original production company that was going to help produce the film. And now James and co. have gone completely independent and, you know, starting from scratch in a way, which is good, you know, new leaf, new direction. But yeah, it's a very ambitious project.
And what are you playing? You know, are you a vampire, werewolf, zombie?
I can't tell you.
Can't tell?
No. But my character's name's Danielle. And I get to keep my Australian accent, which is good.
Sounds like the blonde bimbo that gets killed in the first scene.
No.
Right.
No.
They normally have names like Danielle or, you know, Trixie or something.
Yeah,
like.
I suppose you're probably right there.
Keeping your Aussie accent, that's good. That's
great.
We should see more of that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think, you know, we've probably nearly talked for an hour on that.
That's pretty good.
Well, 50 minutes or so.
Yeah, nice.
So, good luck.
Thank you.
With Lost Not Found, Death Walks the Streets, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us more about horror movies.
We
should do a horror movie review on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Tell
That'd
us
the
good
awesome.
Horror movies that we really need to see.
Yeah, cool. Right.
Thank you, Fitz.
Thank Koso,
you want to say anything?
No.
Koso's been sitting there doing seismic videos of us recording.
He's been working on podcast.com.
Oh, he's been working is what it is.
Podcast.com.
Yeah, he's plugging podcast.com, of which he's the CTO.
Yes.
CTO.
Technical director, CTO, podcast.com. Alrighty, I'm going to go drink more coffee.
Thank
Cheers.
You, Cameron.
Thank you, Fizz.